This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 215, The Edge of Discovery. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. This is going to be another of our special shows as Larry and I get together one more time before convention season kicks in to catch up on the latest Star Trek Discovery news, preview the summer cons, and to make a big announcement about the network. So, let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Larry. Welcome back to The Ready Room. It's been a little while since we talked about Star Trek Discovery, but with the cons coming up, I think it's time that we do it again. How's everything going?
It's going good. And you know, I just think of these days, I think of all the people earlier this year who said they're not really going to do this show. They're not really going to do this series.
It's never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. They're doing it in the same studio where they faked the Apollo moon landings. You know, I mean,
that's what it was about.
It was
and that
really,
explains why there are those photos with fake Klingons on the moon that NASA's been spreading all these years.
Well, right. And they probably shot that stuff in Tunisia, too, or whatever. Jordan. No, it's been good. We're in crazy. I was saying just today, I think things are gone a little loony. I've seen Trek professionals. I've seen Trek fans. I've seen Trek professional fans. Everybody's online and Twitter and Instagram, and people are a little loony and loopy. But I think that's the height of summer con season.
I guess so.
And the fact that, as we will talk about, we're actually finally, for those naysayers, we're getting actual Enterprise. Yeah. We're getting actual Discovery news in Entertainment Weekly and other places. So it's getting exciting. People are actually starting to ratchet up. But at the same time, I'll talk about this later, I think there's still a little bit of a hangover from the 50th. It's kind of interesting. So there's still a lot of mishmash-mush out there online. And of course, I'm the first one that always says all of fandom is not what's online. There's the great silent majority out there. So I think all of them are, when they hear about it, they're excited for Discovery. So anyway, it's an exciting time. It's summer and it's con season and yahoo.
And before we know it, Discovery will be here. It's going to launch on September 24th. And usually this time of year, Larry, you and I heading into September are mainly focused on the new football season and what's going to be happening with our teams. But this year we have new Star Trek in addition to new Pigskin.
What's going on with those Starfleet teams? No, I actually, so here's what, so like the last, you know, 10, 15 years, I put football off until the last day or the day after Star Trek Vegas. It used to be at the Hilton. I would go over to Monday morning when I'm checking out, I would walk in the little, you know, convenience store at the Hilton and pick up whatever sports magazine that would have the poll on it. And I go, okay, it's like peak Trek is over and I'm back to, oh my God, here, they've overrated the Sooners where this year? But now somebody sent me, my friend Don sent me the cover of the ratings like a week ago. And I'm like, no, I'm not geared up to handle football yet. I have to get through San Diego and Vegas. Right. And we have to birth Discovery somewhere along the way.
We have to birth Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Birth and Babies.
That could be a show title right there, Larry.
I just flashed back to Gone with the Wind myself. But
all right. Well, let's get into what we're going to talk about today. This is a special Ready Room. We're not going to do an episode discussion as a feature. We're just going to talk about some of the latest Discovery news. We're going to talk about what's going to be happening with the conventions coming up. Of course, San Diego Comic-Con, Star Trek Las Vegas. Larry, you're going to be at both. And then at the end, we have a really big announcement about the network that I'm excited to tell you about.
Wait, what? What? There's something exciting coming in about the network at the end?
There is something exciting coming in. We might be birthing something exciting, Larry.
Yes, it is exciting. It is. I'm being totally stupid here. You know, it is exciting, and I can't wait to spring on everybody.
So as I mentioned, Discovery launches on September 24th. How that's going to work is there's going to be a special broadcast of the premiere episode on CBS, the actual CBS that everyone can watch. That's at 8:30 Eastern, 7:30 Central on September 24th. Then that premiere episode and the second episode will be available to stream on CBS All Access the same night immediately following that premiere on CBS Network Television. After premiere night, all new episodes will be released weekly on Sundays. And in the U.S., that will be exclusively for CBS All Access subscribers. And as I understand the way it's going to work for people like me who are outside the U.S., the episodes will be available the following day on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I'll get to watch it myself. Thank goodness over here. There's going to be 15 episodes in the first season, but they're going to split these into two chapters.
Right.
We're going to have the first 8 episodes that will run from Sunday the 24th through Sunday, November 5th. And then in January, no specific date given at this time as far as I know, but in January 2018, the second chapter will pick up and we'll get those other 7 episodes. What do you think about splitting it like that, Larry?
I was going to say, in the modern parlance here the last 4 or 5 years of even the network, the full seasons, not even like the mini seasons, the ones that still have 20, 22 episodes, they have their, you know, they have the fall premiere like always, and then they have the fall finale, and then they go just like this, and they come back in January for the spring premiere.
Okay.
It's gotten ridiculous. It's like, no, like really?
See,
fall finale, spring premiere, and but they write arcs. A lot of the shows will write, the drama series especially, will write arcs, you know, to mm-hmm. those. So it's really like you do get 2 half seasons instead of a full season,
yeah,
structurally.
Well, see, that's interesting because when I lived in the U.S., it wasn't like that.
No,
so
no.
It sounds like this is something that has developed since then.
It's just one more way the country's gone to hell since you've been gone, Chris.
I see. Well, that's why I wasn't aware that that was going on. So it makes more sense to me now that they would be doing it that way. But it just seems like quite a long gap for such a short story. I mean, 15 episodes.
Well,
and so many shows these days on streaming services drop the entire stretch of the story on you at once.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, historically, number one used to be that everything was geared, a lot of things were geared around the fall premieres, or you were like the mid-season
right.
shows would start in January if they were replacement
or you
shows.
Were on USA Network and you were a summer show, like
you
the 4400.
Where character counts. But the Nielsen's, the sweeps months, and you know all the years of Next Gen, even though it was syndicated, they would still go by this because the Nielsen still applied to the syndicated shows. They would have the, I think it was the November sweeps. They let shows get established, and then they would take the big hunky-dory detailed measurements to set ad rates in November, and then there would be February sweeps and like April sweeps. And you go back and look at all the, you know, the Next Gens and DS9s and Voyagers, all the two-part shows and all the big event shows
right.
would be in those months. And then,
yeah.
But what's evolved, and those were Voyager was on Dinky UPN and Enterprise to start. But what's evolved now is what we were just saying is that they don't even mess with, they would do that, but you could go back and look at the grids. There would be, you know, like Next Gen's airing in December, right? They would just barely take
a
week or two off for the holidays here. And they would be back in January. They'd show you maybe 2 or 3 weeks of reruns at times. But oh no, now they just give it up after the sweeps month. And, you know, December's off and January's off and half of November's off. And they just give up in favor of the holidays and nobody's measuring ratings and come back. So that has become kind of the standard thing. So this didn't surprise me, but you're right. This isn't a 22 episode season. It grew to 15 from 13, but it's still only 15. But, you know, again, that's in one way that's stretching out. I mean, I think it's as with so many places, CBS and marketing the show and getting it out to as many eyeballs as possible. They're obviously wanting fans and armchair fans and maybe would-be fans, genre fans who might give Star Trek but they're still trying to get out to the great unwashed and the mundanes. And this is actually stretching the season out beyond 15 actual weeks, right?
Right, exactly. So if they do a good job of marketing during that break in particular, this could work out really well. I do agree that it's a good idea when you only have 15 episodes to stretch them out like that to keep interest going for sure.
And people are, people are used to that with their other shows too, and they're almost not even keeping score at home that, wait, there's not 22, there's only 15. Because if they see a delayed premiere that doesn't premiere until later September, yeah, and then it goes into its finale, it's a fall finale, if it takes its break early in November, not later in November, no, they're not really keeping, you know, they're not really keeping up with that. And then it comes back in February. But the hardcores are screaming. But everybody else that they're trying to penetrate to, especially the first year. But the other thing is, it's like the whole, we talked about dropping a whole season versus having a traditional weekly.
Yeah.
I never thought anybody connected with the show would be stupid enough to drop it like some of the streaming shows are done that way. But they're not Star Trek.
Right.
They're not Star Trek. And that the whole power, the bang for the buck of having everybody debated online, the week by week, you know, publicity.
That's the really important factor, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes. And if you have that November to January gap, what you're doing, I mean, people are going to be distracted by holidays and things, but you've still got, people are going to be online and talking about this and debating it, whether you gave them a 1 month gap or you give them a 3 month gap. It's all going to be percolating up. So why not?
I mentioned, Larry, you and I are both big college football fans, and that's what has happened with college football. The season is quite short, but the podcast industry and the media industry surrounding college football has become year-round, and people just debate it all year-round. And Star Trek is exactly the same way, and having this gap is going to give all of us a wonderful opportunity through the holidays to debate what's going to happen.
Right.
When we come back.
Well, we've had, as I've called it, the 12 fallow years here. We've been wandering in the desert. And in the meantime, social media has, you know, been birthed and grown. We keep coming back to birth. Has been born and grown up.
A lot of birthing going on today, Larry.
And there's a series coming to birth here in a minute that's going to come up in the middle of the social media age. And it's the first Star Trek that's been, I mean, Enterprise and Voyager were online, but it was the primitive, message boards. Nothing like now. And nothing like 24, and nothing like having a blogger on every block and a video blogger, in every pot. So there's so much attention and scrutiny and bandwidth going into this that it's just a new world, and it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. And yeah, it's a paid or unpaid. It's a whole industry that didn't exist the last time Star Trek was a weekly series.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And really, and the whole thing of being on streaming, all the whole double duty of A, you have to pay to see it, that it's on CBS All Access, and then how CBS All Access as a business entity, if Star Trek performed, it's like we're not on the bubble as far as Nielsen ratings, but it'll be interesting to see how Star Trek performs to what they're expecting it to as a business for what the plans are for the bigger picture for that is.
I mean, I know people in the U.S. are upset that it's not going to be on Netflix in the U.S., but if you stop and think about it, when we talk about the business side of CBS All Access, if All Access tanks, they've got a fallback, immediate fallback. Mm-hmm. You've got Netflix. So I know people don't want to pay for CBS All Access, but the fact that it's distributed by Netflix everywhere else, and we've heard how much of the tab has been picked up by the money CBS has brought in from that deal, it's actually kind of good for the security of the show, I think.
Right.
And the continuity of the show, because Netflix would be more than happy to continue it. So just a little speculation, but
we're all totally into speculation here, but if Discovery is not quote unquote good enough, or if there's not enough numbers there to keep All Access afloat, will everyone still, Netflix has its worldwide perspective on this, so it would be in obviously it's in their interest to keep it going. And if that's enough leverage on, if CBS becomes disappointed, All Access tanked, because are they going to be so soured that they will pull the plug? Or will they say, okay, that was a bummer, fire those guys, and let's move ahead. And, you know, that will that taint Star Trek? Will that doom Star Trek? And yeah, Netflix standing there holding half of the tab or upping it. And of course, if it went to Netflix in the U.S., that would be a huge pot that wasn't there, existing already. Whatever deal they would have with them. So hopefully if All Access did not succeed, it would not pull Discovery down with it, is what we're saying. So, but it would still, it'd be a negative hanging out there, but let's just get there when we get there.
We'll see. It just popped in my mind as we were talking that, that's a little bit of a safety valve that we have. And I was mainly thinking about Netflix, because as we talk about this being the first Star Trek during the social media era, it's also the first Star Trek where everyone around the world is going to be able to see it and take part in the experience. In first run, that's never happened before.
Right.
And I think that's going to be
good
really
point.
Neat.
Yes. And the fact you're a day later, but that's amazing.
that's nothing. I mean, I'm a day ahead of you in the first place, Larry. So maybe a day later.
Shh, don't tell anybody. All you guys in Asia, Australians and the Kiwis and you guys are all, we're actually seeing it the same day or something. I don't know.
That's right.
It's like this temporal stuff gives me a headache.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the new details that we've gotten over the past couple of days and few weeks. A big one that just came out were some new images. These were published in Entertainment Weekly as part of their Comic-Con preview issue, and we're getting to see Klingons again. We see Mary Shafo, who is Klingon Commander Laurel, and Chris Obi T'Kuvma together in one image. And there's also a little sidebar, a little caption that goes along with this, which explains that T'Kuvma is a leader of an ancient Klingon house, and he goes to extreme measures to unite his people. And this suggests, as Trek Movie pointed out, that these are not the same Klingons that we are accustomed to, which makes me wonder, what would it be like? What would it mean for the Star Trek universe if Discovery explores the culture of Kronos and we learn that the Klingons that we know from all the Star Trek that we've seen before are not the only ones on Kronos? And here's this other group of Klingons, kind of like we saw the Enar on Andoria during Enterprise's fourth season. And the culture is expanded, a race that we're very familiar with. We find out that there's much more depth to them than we knew before, which, of course, in reality would be true. What do you think about that?
Well, okay. This is what I have said for longtime listeners of this series know that I've been saying this for ages, that the people who are getting upset, of all the things people to wonder about and question and be concerned about canon and visual canon on Discovery, the Klingons haven't concerned me that much, because I think the Klingons are ripe and long overdue for, for lack of a better term, some species diversity. And one of the things that Star Trek is prey to, and people acknowledge it, but still, we wish it wasn't a limiting factor, was TV budgets. And only being able to do so much with a movie budget when you get one is getting, and like you said, the Anar for Andorians, when Tim Russ was cast as Tuvok, in an attempt to there was a faction that said, what do you mean? There's no black Vulcans.
Yeah, that was a huge thing at the time.
Yes, at the time. But leading into Tim's casting, to build that up, they had cast a black actor as a Romulan admiral in The Pegasus, who was on Viewscreen, right? But basically it was like, look, the Vulcanoid race, Vulcans, Romulans, there's some species diversity here too, right? So there's, when they've tried to be sensitive to the fact, and there were Asian actors playing Vulcans. Somebody pointed out there were a lot of Asians playing Vulcans in the scenes of Star Trek III on Vulcan. So it's a little good thing. So all these different, and then we've had all, and my God, I said today on Twitter, I said, somebody was griping about the Klingons, and I said, hey, go easy on the Klingons. Their DNA has been through a lot.
That's great.
Because it has. So,
it has.
So, this is, I said a week or two ago, I was thinking and I thought, guys, this isn't trivia, it's texture. we should welcome some, as long as we seem to have a lot of really, which was like a sad news story in its own right, a lot of good canon background people. I know you can never have everything under your belt, but we do have the internet now, and we do have Memory Alpha quoting all of us, but right. We do have, or not quoting us, but it's in good hands to at least be acknowledging that. And then to have this ancient Klingon angle. Now, as somebody pointed out, does that mean that these are ancient Klingons or the house goes back a long way? But right. Either way.
Yeah, we won't know until we see the story.
But either way, I said ages ago, there were people floating the idea of a new series being a Klingon-only series or mini-series. And this clearly isn't that. But I said when Game of Thrones got so big, I said, well, what about a Game of Houses? Thinking mm-hmm. the Klingon Empire and all the Klingon, just the whole psyche would be so ripe and ready for that kind of a drama among houses. And then they wouldn't just be extras standing behind the council table at the Great Hall. They would actually right. have a purpose and a reason and a background. So, yeah, I'm good with all of this. And the more they dribble out facts, the more it becomes, maybe these could be throwbacks. Maybe they could be, not Botany Bay Klingons, but maybe they could be, or Prophecy Klingons, but maybe they could have a lot of that going on.
And it's always possible. I mean, we don't know a lot about Kronos. We don't know a lot about the geography of that planet. It's possible right. that this is a group of Klingons that are isolated on some part of the planet, and they do look significantly different than the Klingons right. that are the dominant Klingons, that are the spacefaring right. Klingons.
They have a whole empire. They have a whole empire that takes up an awful lot of square cubic spaceage.
That's the official technical term. Yes,
that's just, yeah. And Dayton Ward's new book, his travel guide to Klingon, his Kronos, just came out. So I don't know if he quite got into this, if he was privy to all the Discovery secrets yet. But yeah, no, it works. And then I'm just looking at this, back to this image. When you stop and remember, I'm thinking of the Klingons held captive on Coria 4 and the half Klingon, half Romulan daughter that was supposed to be the scandal. This kind of has the same, of course, there was supposed to be a mix there, but this... The female outfit that what's her name that Mary Cheffo's character is wearing here,
Laurel.
It kind of has that same skirted bodice. She's not quite like she needs a bustle on the back, but I mean that kind of tailoring is in there too. But as far as the Klingon, we got to the point where we started seeing across Next Gen and DS9. We started the clerics show. Right, with Kalis, the idea that people who would stop and think about this, of course, to have a civilization that functioned, even if you were a quote unquote warrior race, we eventually saw Klingon clerics, we saw Klingon attorneys, we saw Klingon chefs, we saw all these different aspects of Klingon society.
I mean, society couldn't function without these people,
right? So. So, yeah, this is another step toward that. And, we forget. It's a positive. It's not a negative. So after humanity, I would dare say that the Klingons are still, and the Borg aren't a real civilization, so they can be wacky-doodle-all drones. But, the Ferengi and the Vulcans and all of that, it's almost like I think the Klingons passed the Vulcans over the long haul and maybe the most developed civilization that we have in Star Trek. And this is just one more aspect of that, if you stop and think about it.
Okay. So you feel the Klingons are one of the most developed civilizations that we have in Star Trek?
Yeah, as a fictional... Mm. Right. I mean, it started off out of the gate, the Vulcans were, obviously, and all the affection for
I mean,
Spock.
I would argue that the Cardassians and the Bajorans are probably the most...
They've come a long way. They've come a long way. I would say the Cardassians and the... Because the Cardassians really got their shot on DS9, but the Klingons had all the TNG years and then even a little more on even Enterprise. But
they definitely have more screen time. I just don't know if they were as developed. But again, we could be completely wrong. Maybe these are regular old Klingons and they just changed the makeup because, hey, it'd be fun to make them look different. But maybe that's not what's going on here. Maybe all the uproar is for nothing and they actually have some
The uproar is for nothing? Oh, no, Chris.
I know. It would be the first time ever in social media, Larry, that the uproar was about nothing. I know.
It would be the first time in Star Trek fandom. It would be the first time in like snail mail paper and Stacey fandom. Yeah.
All right.
Gosh.
So enough about the Klingons. Let's talk about something else that was here. EW also had some more details about the relationships shared by Michael Burnham. That's Sonequa Martin-Green's character, mm-hmm. our lead for the series. Ambassador Sarek, and also Captain Georgiou. And there was some information in there that said, at the behest of Spock's father, Sarek, Yo's Philippa Georgiou has mentored Martin Green's Michael Burnham for 7 years as Burnham rose through the Federation ranks, and Georgiou now feels her protege is ready to take command of her own ship. Now, we already know that Burnham grew up on Vulcan and attended the Vulcan Science Academy, something we speculated about when we mm-hmm. saw those very first images. And now we know that's the case. So here, there's a bit more of a connection between Sarek and Georgiou anyway. And he certainly has trusted her to mentor Burnham.
Right. I was just, it was really funny. I just noticed that they specifically say that that Georgiou has mentored her. Well, they're in Starfleet. She had to go through her officer. I don't think she got a brevet rank to lieutenant commander or whatever, a field commission. She went through all the hassles that she had to do somewhere between the Vulcan Science Academy. But I just was laughing at how it was 7 years. Like right. somewhere there's a lost syndicated series done in the 90s of Sonequa as Michael Burnham, and we just haven't found it yet. But the Paramount accountants, it was another 7 year syndicated series that was never going to go shorter, never going to go longer. With $1.5 million per budget.
Well, I was also noticing that 7 years is a very important time cycle on Vulcan, Larry.
Yes, yes. Well, I was going to get to that after we made the initial joke, but yes, yes. But then as a behind the scenes thing, it struck me that this is the third actor. I believe this is the first Star Trek character, even with the reboot, if the Kelvin timeline JJ movies recasting, obviously. I think this is the first time that a Star Trek major, quasi-major character has been played by three different actors.
There's one other. If you're going to say quasi-major,
I'm not talking
very
about
important character.
You're going to throw Zial at me?
Yes, Zial is very important to the story,
okay.
though.
Okay, but she was on. I'm not. Please don't send me all the Bajoran Cardassian hate mail here of one time, you know, occupation.
Oh, so Larry, you have offended so many people that the Bajorans and the Cardassians are going to lay down their weapons, right. settle their differences just to write hate mail to you.
Well, I guess together. I have a role that I do have a reason to exist.
So,
okay.
In a way, Larry, you're a peacemaker.
Thank you. My point is, in the long haul of Star Trek, I'm not making judgments here. Okay. I'm just saying that Zial yeah. as a character does not compare with Sarek as a character. So sorry about that. But you know what I'm saying. This is the first, you know, Sarek is a major recurring character. And I'm sorry for everybody who came in with Voyager. I'm talking about the long haul, the fact that when there were seven or eight regular characters, and yes, in the first movie, Rand was brought back, Grace Lee Whitney. And even though Sarek wasn't there, Mark Lenard made such an impact with his two or three. You know, Mark Lenard was the first guy to play three different aliens, the three different major aliens after the first movie. He was a Romulan, a Klingon, and a Vulcan, Klingon in motion picture, the captain. And then, you know, not so much Wrath of Khan, but then from Search for Spock onward, he was in more often than not in the movies. And that was a testament to the power of Sarek and the power that mm-hmm. Mark Leonard brought to him. And that he only, you know, Harry Mudd was in who is also a recurring star here, but the original series was not heavy on what we now think of as recurring characters like Q or yeah. O'Brien before he was a regular and all of that. But Sarek only had the one appearance. He made two guest spots as the Romulan commander. But that he had such power, and it didn't hurt that you were the number one breakout character's dad, you know, Spock's father. Yeah. So that's what I'm comparing here. And it, to me, it's interesting that was so much of an impact that they brought yeah. the character back. Yeah.
Well, no, absolutely, because he's such an important character that they brought him back here. There's no doubt that Sarek's role in the Star Trek timeline is extremely right. important. Can I annoy you just a little bit more, though?
Sure. I'm just saying, it just struck me that this is the first time as major a character as that has been played by three people, which yeah. I thought was a great testament to the character. Yeah.
Which I would add, Larry, some people might be thinking that that's trivia, but It's texture, right?
That's great, Chris. I've never thought of that before.
So here's a little more annoying trivia for you, though, Larry. So if you include the movies, Sarek has 7 appearances in Star Trek.
Okay.
How many times was Z'all on Deep Space Nine? 9 episodes, Larry. That's 2 more than Sarek.
Okay. And I know you're throwing in the guy that played young Sarek at the birthing scene in 5. I'm talking about major appearances. Jesus Christ, we can parrot Dan here. I'm talking about in the real world here.
Okay, well, in the real world, yes.
In the real world of Star Trek, not the little, you know, little parsing it here into the millions
But so let's do this. So later in the show, we're going to come back around to Sarek one more time. And at that point, I might ask you for a few more thoughts on Sarek.
Okay.
Being part of the Discovery story. Until then, let's move on to another item here, something that was revealed in a tweet on July 15th by Jason Isaac, who plays Captain Lorca of the Discovery. He tweeted, in other news, some particularly weird, fabulous shit on Star Trek Discovery today with the Jonathan Frakes directing, no less. No wonder. So we found out that Jonathan Frakes came in to direct Discovery.
And he subsequently tweeted something to the same effect, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's great. I mean, Frakes, for me, is one of... There are a handful of people from Star Trek, the actors who directed, who you really think of them when you think of director. There are a lot of actors who directed 1 or 2 episodes and people don't really notice or think much about it. But Frakes, of course, is a big name. Thanks largely
the first and
to
biggest.
First Contact and so forth.
Well, right.
Bringing him in, I think it's wonderful. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, no. It's really cute. Now, he directed an episode of The Orville earlier. So I think, if I may... So here's some more texture, not trivia, that he's the first person to work on both of these series, maybe? But no,
that's probably true, Larry. I think you're pretty safe in saying that.
What was cute was also watching the actors and the writers all Instagramming and tweeting and basically, you know, fan feigning about having Jonathan around, you know, because he did prep meetings and he was on stage. And here's all these actors who are professional and writers and crew people. And they're all, you know, oh, my God, we have Riker here. And feeling very like, okay, now we've been touched by Star Trek royalty and Star Trek realness. You know, we're not the orphan new kids on the block. We're real Star Trek now because Frakes has been here and is lending his, you know, his DNA to us now. He's in our he's in our bloodline. So we're real. It was cute to see all that happening. Again, all these people on social media, it's fun to keep up with them and watch it when it happens in real time. And feel like it's there. As much Definitely. As CBS is sitting on the news flow, as they would and you'd expect, and as much as it's exciting to get these little exclusive blurbs from EW, that is one way you can feel that we couldn't do 20 years ago, or 15, is to follow the social media channels of the actors and writers and see those things in real time when they happen.
Definitely, very exciting. And I wonder if it's going to open the door for others like LeVar Burton or Roxanne Dawson or people like this to come
in. Or Robbie down the line. Yeah. We'll see.
So that would be interesting. I think it's interesting because those guys, one reason they're so successful as directors on Star Trek is that they really understood what Star Trek of that time period, TNG, DS9, Voyager, Enterprise, what that was, and visually and stylistically what that was. And Discovery is going to be different. And how does that translate over? How does their vision of Star Trek merge with this new look and new writing style and new storytelling style that they're bringing to Discovery?
But at the same time, like fans tend to do, we shouldn't do that. I mean, Jonathan and Robbie and Roxanne and LeVar, they haven't been in cubicles on the Botany Bay all this time. They've been out directing real world TV.
Right.
They're up with the trends. They're up with all the hot shows of going, you know, that are out there. So it's not like they're walking in from the freezer, and in danger of bringing the best of 2005 with them. So yeah, it should be exciting, and obviously. Obviously, everybody with the show is excited to have him, which was just kind of sweet to see happening. So, yeah, I'm excited.
And then there was that one guy in the back that said, "Chef's here."
Chef. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
So here's another little bit of trivia slash texture. That's the fact that CNET is now owned by CBS. And on July 6th, CNET released a video interview with Alex Kurtzman, who is a producer on Discovery. And of course, everyone knows his connection with the Kelvin Timeline movies, also known as the Abramsverse. And he talked a bit about Discovery. Trek Movie transcribed the interview, and Kurtzman promised a unique story. He actually said it's a very unique story, or at least Berman has a very unique story, which as an editor, I immediately said, there are no degrees of uniqueness. And then I told myself to be quiet and just pay attention to the rest of the stuff that he said.
Just enjoy the Hollywood speak.
Exactly. So there were four main questions that he addressed in here, and I'm actually going to read the transcript that Trek Movie put on their site so I can get your thoughts on this. The first one is Kurtzman talking about Discovery's story and Michael Burnham. And he said, the story that we have for season one is really interesting and special and pays tribute to a lot of what Trek has done. And in many ways is actually doing it in a new way. To have Soniqua and Michelle as captains of our ship is really, really exciting and different. I love stories that are based around strong women, and we have some strong women on that show. Having Soniqua, she is a very, very special actress, is bringing a flavor to the character which I haven't really seen in Trek, and that is really exciting. Her story is very unique and draws on some really interesting things in Trek lore. I think fans will both appreciate, and I'm certain it will be a cause of much debate. So yeah, I think he's right. It's going to be a cause of much debate no matter what they do. But any thoughts there? Yeah. Of course,
Just hearing you read that, I was just having a flashback to the height of the Berman. I think Alex gets the Rick Berman Award for saying so much and saying so little.
I would say it's like his little in communicator when you guys would have the interviews with him, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like Rick would go on, well, I feel like we have a very exciting story that's going to be very unique and really show off the... What, like Rick is going to say, or like Alex is going to say, well, you know, the first three of the nine stories, they're just kind of so-so. But, some of them are kind of exciting, but we'll just muddle along with the other ones that aren't. It's the best we could do. We had a big deadline. You know, we had all that uproar, and we just, like, no, right. They're not going to say that. So all
we gave the pilot all we had, and then we ran into some problems with episode two, and we told everyone, like, just throw something on the page, take a vacation, come back, and in episode five, we'll just figure it out.
These guys from All Access are calling me every 15 minutes. How's it going?
Yeah, of course he's not going to say that.
No.
Yeah.
So I just love it. Oh, it's a unique story. Well, you know... Right. Michael Burnham's character arc is going to be like, oh, I think we've done this seven times already across the entire Star Trek canon. No.
Larry, I was listening to an interview with the writers of Spider-Man Homecoming on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and they were telling the interviewer that we've told this story three times before in three different ways, in three different vehicles. And so we thought, how can we tell it again, but make it different? And I yelled, don't tell it again. Come up with a new story, a new idea. So
I don't know, because there's always 47 people out there that don't know the Spider-Man origin story. So we have to, can't you do it in the titles, like in a comic book or something, and just jump right? I don't know.
It in a comic book that leads into the movie. And if you don't read the comic book, then you don't quite understand what's going on.
But then you'd have to go, like, sell a comic book and make money off that ahead of time with a movie. And that's just a lot of hassle. Who wants to do that? Oh, wait. Yeah.
Okay. So that was the first thing. Second one, how Discovery connects to the original Star Trek. And Alex said, if you are a fan of Trek, you are going to see a lot of things which harken back to the original series and elements of the original series. I am not just talking plot, but the spirit of what that show was. We are going to be revisiting a couple of things on Star Trek Discovery that I think people are going to find familiar. Without spoiling anything, we are adhering to a timeline and sticking to the rules, but also I think finding some new areas and avenues that have only been alluded to, but never fully explored. So I'm not going to ask you if that's a good idea to find areas that haven't been explored, because you and I have talked about that over and over. But
it's called gap filling. Yes.
Yeah. What I'll ask is that based on what you've seen, based on what you've read so far, do you feel that this is the case, that they're following a timeline and they're sticking to the rules? Or
because
that's a debate that fans are having out there for sure.
Yeah, I know. Well, I tried to say early on, A, when we talk about canon, there's concept canon and there's visual canon. And both of them, and I said all along that I thought it was easier for writers on a page to sit down and worry about to get the concept canon better than corralling a bunch of creatives. And I've said this before, telling them what they have to do. You have to go back and recreate this. Although I think it can be just as big a challenge. I don't think anybody does, as I've said, nobody does a World War II movie and sits down to recreate American and German soldier uniforms. You're not being not creative if you don't, well, I have to do this because I want to put my own spin on it. And if you look at Star Trek as future history, it's been established, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But having said that, the uniforms don't like, we are, our yardstick here is the cage, which obviously was the first pilot. It's the oldest. It was the one done on the biggest budget, on the biggest crunch. Everything else was, you know, refurbished and had everything else to monetize out of that. And we'll see. The more things have gone, like today, people who are all panties in a wad over the Klingons, they're talking about them being an ancient house. People like me are sitting here, we're talking about species diversity, but some people who are very literal were looking at that. But some of the writers, Ted Sullivan, and a lot of them who are online, a lot of them are talking about, no trust. And here's Alex again saying, no. And Alex took a lot of bashing for the movies at times. And even Bob Orsi came off as the biggest, even though he took a lot of flack too. And then he ultimately got his script rejected on the third one. But he had the reputation as being the biggest fanboy, and Alex was number two to him, and they were originally writing partners and fans. So I mean he's from Next Generation era, Alex is onward, especially as his grew up with that. But I want to take them at their word, and I want to say that if nothing else, I think the concept canon, you know, when we talk about this being 10 years before Kirk's era, Kirk's original mm-hmm. series Command. And the visuals, we'll just have to wait. Maybe they'll pull a rabbit out of the hat and explain why this is not the velour of Pike's time. I don't know, but we'll see. But concept canon, I don't know. I'm like, how do you mess that up? That's just words on a page. And supposedly we have a lot of Kirsten Beyer, who everybody's pointing to her aside from coordinating comic books and books with the show. And I saw something today where supposedly they're going to make a big effort to trying to make the spin-off books and comics, if not officially canon, like in their mind canon, the way that Jerry Taylor originally meant for her novels to tie into Janeway for Voyager. That's her. And so Kirsten's on staff, and she's supposed to be the human walking encyclopedia as well as all the other fanboys and girls. So
yeah, she's wonderful. Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, I think it makes sense to make the books and the comics canon this time around, because if you look at the marketing mix that goes into things, you know, JJ did that with the Kelvin films. You've got especially comics that tie into those movies. And, you know, you and I were talking the other day, and I can't remember what led up to it, but then I said, oh, well, are you talking about, when you talk about Mudd, are you talking about Harry Mudd's half-Bajoran daughter? And you said, please tell me that that's some kind of inside Trek film joke or something. And I told you that, nope, that's from the comics. And in Into Darkness, when they're getting ready to take the shuttle down, and they say, prep the shuttle that we recovered during the Mudd incident last month, that was a reference to that issue of the comic. So they do tie it all together, and it does make sense for it to all be canon.
And when you refreshed me on that, I did remember for like 10 seconds being aware of that. Yeah. I wouldn't have caught it. No, I will say, comics-wise, thank God for Countdown on the first movie, because it made they retconned why the supernova did. It was a subspace shockwave supernova, which then it can be all kind. It can jump, hop up and down, and pop out wherever it wants to.
It's a fancy one, right?
Yes, it's a fancy one. But when I was working on stellar cartography, and I was having to make this all be literal in an actual space and make sense, it was like, well, thank God for that. But you could tell the writers were going back and and filling in the gaps of what made absolutely no sense, and giving it a, you know, the Hobus star and the other couple other stars involved. So, yeah. so no, they do have a place. It's just for so many years, I had to give up. I would read comics as a lark, but you know, they would even go through. They would change off licensees. It would be Marvel and then DC and then Marvel and then the other one. and they wouldn't tie into each other necessarily, and characters would be brought in. Now we have all the memory beta, and everybody who tracks all this stuff now, all the comics experts will go back and say, or you'll see it places, you know, Harry Mudd was this in the Marvel comics, or his dad's pet dog was named this in the DC comics, or it was named this in the Marvels, or it was named this in the IDW reboot, you know. So there wasn't a lot. Of course, we're talking about 30 and 40 years of things evolving to where no one's thinking to keep track of it. So yeah, it's a little bit of a, dare I say the word, reboot on attitude, but it's such a different kind of corner. And it's only 15 episodes, and they're not cranking out 22 or 26 for 7 years that we know of. So maybe there's a little more feeling of they have, I think it's a cross between feeling like there's more room to play with, and also that it's just 2017 and people are more up with that attitude versus 20 years ago when it was like, no, if we do that, then we have to start paying rates and rights, you know, to the comic writers, and we're not in control of them. Who knows what they're doing? Well, it's a different paradigm now, and we'll see what happens. It's awesome. Right. I may have to start buying and paying attention to comics now.
Yeah, you should. I mean, you talked about earlier that Bob Orsi was known as being such a big Star Trek fan, being a fanboy, and it maybe doesn't come through on the screen in those two movies, but it does come through in the comics. If you read the Kelvin Timeline comics, which he oversaw, you can tell that he really knew Star Trek, and I think those comics were much better.
Well, the movies,
by far, than the movies, for sure.
The movies were committed. The movies were ultimately a committee that JJ directed. Yeah, and the comics are much easier for a small group to write to originate and give notes on and ride herd over without having all the hands in the pie. So is that the metaphor?
So before we go on to the next point here, going back to the uniforms, if you use the cage as the starting point, then you really wonder, well, what's going on with the uniforms? Like, these uniforms make no sense. But if you take the entire Star Trek timeline that's established at this point, and especially if you consider the fact that, well, you know, the cage wasn't actually aired originally, and they started out with the revised Star Trek, which we did get to see.
And then you look at Enterprise. Don't weasel on me, Chris. Don't start weaseling on me.
And then you look at Enterprise, and you look at the Starfleet uniforms of the 22nd century, then you can see that there is a logical progression in this uniform design with the blues moving forward that does make sense on the Starfleet timeline. So it's the tricky thing about Star Trek, right? You establish one thing in the 60s, and then over the decades, you keep adding in the backstory, and eventually you end up with what we have with Enterprise forward. And if you use Enterprise as the starting point, it's not so odd that these uniforms look the way they do.
Right. And, you know, and the little nerdy guy in me that loves to see things picked up and used, that's one thing. But again, we've already dealt with a world where supposedly, like Kirk's era, original era, the 2260s, they're running around in the gold and blue and red pajama tops. And then within 2 years, they're wearing all the pastel, you know, Space 1999 jumpsuits in the motion picture. And that's all supposed to be just 2 years later, you know, 2.5 years later. So we have had this precedent for rapid, you know, abrupt, severe uniform style changes and equipment gear changes and typography and all of that. Well, so,
Larry, it's like any other organization, you know, you've got leaders, people are running Starfleet, you've got people running the Starfleet art department, you've got people running the Starfleet fashion school. Someone leaves, new person comes in, they have completely different tastes. You know, one person hates all that bright stuff, says, let's go pastel. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got someone comes in right before Kirk comes on the ship, and they said, that blue stuff is just too plain. You know, we need to spice things up here. And they go with the bright colors, so...
Do you really like that gold transporter beam? I'm thinking we should have it be kind of bluish and kind of, yeah.
Right, right. Yeah.
Every 2 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's the stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
You know, we don't hear about it on the screen because it's not very interesting from a storytelling point of view, but if Star Trek's real, if this universe is real, that stuff goes on. I know. VP leaves, new VP comes in, and
right,
things change. So,
and yeah, we just save that for the novelist to handle. So
exactly, know, yeah.
The Kevin and Dayton,
very
or David,
interesting
or right
series about the inner workings of Starfleet management. Okay, so another thing that Alex said here, they asked how Discovery is respecting Star Trek canon. And he said, you have got a room full of people with very different and very devoted relationships to Star Trek in that writer's room. And that carries on a pretty proud tradition of Trek being written by fans. You have to respect canon as it's being written. You cannot say, that never happened. No, 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 you can't do that. They would kill you. Star Trek fans would kill you. No, you have to respect canon. You have to understand the timelines and what the different timelines were, and what the different universes were, and how they all worked together. To which I say, good luck with that. That's my comment. Okay, but Alex continues, you have to keep very meticulous track of who, what, where, when, and why. And we have people in the writer's room whose sole mm-hmm. job is to say, nope, can't do that. So they are at least trying to stay on top of it, I guess.
Well, that's what I was getting back to. Although two things. One, facetiously, is, well, you know, Alex, we would have had only one timeline if it hadn't been for
that's
you.
What I was thinking when I was reading it.
And
like,
I don't
you
think
had to
the
throw
mirror,
another timeline in there, did you?
The mirror universe timeline and all the mini ones, you know, like the Klingon War from yesterday, all the one-off that we saw in different episodes and even into Voyager would have been something else. But, you know, mirror timeline would just slap a goatee on somebody and it's the mirror universe. Yeah, we only would have had one. But I thought it was cute. It's his comment about, oh, they've always had fan writers in the writer's room to handle stuff. And I went to go, no, this is like looking at the journey from this end of the trip, right? It's like, no, the first few years of Next Generation, especially outside of, especially when Dorothy and David left right out of the gate. After that, you didn't have fanboy. In fact, in the early days of Next Gen, if you showed up anywhere on staff, Mike Okuda and Rick Sternbach and other people, Eric Stillwell, when he was a PA, if you opened your mouth about being too much of a fan of original series, you were looked at as a leaker, and you probably wouldn't get the job. Or if you're going to make trouble and argue things, you know, Mike, to show their testament there, especially Mike, but Mike and Rick were very diplomatic, and after a while, that became their in. They became the technical advisors, and you know, Mike set up this whole shadow canonization in the background that he was adding in all these layers that he wasn't really getting paid to do, but he did that. But but they weren't writers. It wasn't until like Ron Moore got paid for his spec script the third season, and then Ira came in, who had extensive credit. You know, Ron Moore was a baby writer. Ira had years of writing experience. And then bit by bit, it wasn't even, and then they both left, and then Ron was there, and then Brannon kinda, and then Renee Echevarria was a fan, and Naren Shankar, science advised. But I mean, it wasn't until the core guys of DS9 took over after Michael left, and then even Voyager wasn't until the late stages, and it wasn't really until Enterprise when the fanboys were really running the show. So his line about, oh, they've always had uber fans in the writer's room. If they did, they were like down and quiet the first half of the 18-year run of the Berman era. And if they were a fanboy, they could easily be, they were usually in the minority and could be outvoted. Yeah. And they could for sure be outvoted by whoever the showrunner was until it was one of them, like when it was Michael. And then Rick at the top. And Rick had his own unique mix of views on the original series. So,
yeah,
you know, so anyway, well, that's the one thing in Alex's statement here that I take exception to. But what they did in those days was they had, like, the original series had Kellum DeForest, and then Kellum DeForest's old secretary ran the continuity thing, and they would get memos back. They had a science advisor, and they had and Joan Pierce was her name. And her company did it all the years of all the shows, and they would do memos, and it would be everything from, you can't name that Catherine Janeway because there's a real Catherine Janeway, or there's a real Edward Jellicoe. Yeah. You know, they would look for legal things, but they would also do inner show continuity. You know, there was an episode the second year of Next Generation where we did so-and-so. Do you suggest changing this to blah, 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 or altering this to... I mean, they did both sides. They did real-world continuity notes and legal and, and that. So they so apparently what I've heard is that they're not hiring an outside continuity person. They're depending on the staff writers who are already there. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. We'll see how it goes.
Well, I think, you know, I took it a bit differently than you did. When he said that that carries on a pretty proud tradition of Trek being written by fans, the way I took that was because they have Kirsten Beyer, for example, on the writing staff, that over the past decade in particular, the Star Trek universe has been filled in almost entirely in the literary space. And you have people like Kirsten who took the end of the Voyager story and really continued that. And in the eyes of most people I've talked to who have read it all, who are big Voyager fans, and even people who didn't like Voyager, think she's done an amazing job of evolving this and, of course, sticking to the continuity as well. Right. So I sort of took
And even pulling in non-Voyager threads when they made sense, to pull out things from all the other series and weave them in a good way.
And to do that, you have to know the canon and you have to know all the details. And I took Alex's statement to be a little bit more that they have those people and that they're bringing that proud tradition of Trek being written by the fans into the writer's room this time for the show, as opposed to saying that in the past there had been fans in the writer's room.
Oh, okay.
But as you say, there certainly were people in the writer's room over the years who had certain levels of fandom, I think, and the dynamics of that had to be managed, as you were describing, for sure. Right.
Well, and you know, again, they did early on, but even then, when they did have them, they were in the minority, and they would have to argue their positions, and sometimes go home and go, ugh, they don't get it. And the same thing would be true through all the other the creative departments too. There'd be times when things would want to be done and get overruled, and
everyone has their own interpretations. But it's good to know that the writer's room here is certainly trying to respect Star Trek canon. Now, the last point on why we still need Roddenberry's vision. Alex said, I think that the core of Roddenberry's vision, and I think that is why it has endured for as long as it has, is the belief that human beings will always find a way to persevere and connect to each other, and that there is an optimistic outlook to where we can be going. And now more than ever, we need that desperately. So he gives you hope. Star Trek gives you hope. And yeah, I mean, that is the core of Star Trek, and I hope that they would carry that forward. We are sort of in a culture with television and film, and especially in science fiction, where everything is, you know, destruction and dystopia. Mm-hmm. And putting that optimism back in is something that I think we definitely need. And Star Trek really tries to do that.
Well, what's striking to me is we are back in the mid-60s when Star Trek exploded in the first place. The mid-60s was
the world situation. Yeah, what's going on?
The world situation. I mean, Vietnam and the Green Movement was just starting to explode, and overpopulation and drugs eventually, you know, drug and addiction problems and mental health were starting to become. But people were worried about nuking the planet and would we, you know, blow ourselves up. And there was a time in the 90s, you know, and the carpeted Enterprise and all that. And I was thinking, well, people are loving the intellectual side, but I didn't know in a deep subtextual way, fandom came to Next Generation and all the spinoffs for the same reasons. Oh, look, it's intelligent, rational people all working together no matter where they come from. There's no crap. There's no backbiting. The, you know, people are getting along, all that. But it wasn't quite as visceral as it was in the time, and it wasn't even on the page and on the screen as it was in the original series. Part of that was just the difference in time and culture. But I remember thinking, gosh, if things go along like this, is Star Trek never going to be as powerful with its audience as it was in the 60s because of the world situation? And I didn't mean to like, gee, can we go back and, you know, have a world war and a Great Depression so that people can wish they think they need inspiration and hope again and have things that bad? And then 9/11 happened, and then Enterprise tried to pivot and go that way. But What's amazing is they first announced this show as a business entity that will find its people and concept later.
Right.
You know, that's what true. Was it like November 2015?
Yeah, something right around then, yeah.
And no one knew what was going to happen with global politics, with all the Russian meddling in all these different countries, including our election, and just the way our election went in the States, and just the mood of people. And even when Brian came to the show, he was coming to it, I think, at the beginning with, here's all the things that I think Star Trek could catch up on. Aside from telling a great out-of-the-box story, here's the story concepts, and here's also what the media landscape, by being a streaming service, will let us do structure-wise, you know, content, you know, what we can do. And I think that he was full of all that. And then as the our prime timeline evolved, more and more people were saying, "Oh my God, we're going to be so ready for a Star Trek." And we, you know, all the dystopian shows are out there, and there was a lot of that, not so much on TV being science fiction, but the movies and the books and the sci-fi were that way in the 60s. And soon to be, especially like, but even after Star Trek was off the air, the early 70s were that way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think we're really, really, it's really odd. I wouldn't have wished this on anybody, but it is odd how we're ripe and ready. And it feels a lot like the late 60s in a lot of ways. Some people will still say, no, the 60s were way, way more dour. Vietnam, everybody was being drafted and boys were being sent over, and it was tearing the country apart. And then we got into Watergate with Nixon and everything. And as the rerun generation, you know, kept continually embracing Star Trek through the 70s mm-hmm. into the first movie. So
that's an interesting parallel.
Yeah, it is oddly feeling like we've come full circle. But my worries about in the 90s with the dot-com boom, that, oh, well, things are going to, we're on this permanent plateau and no one's ever going to need to look to Star Trek the same way. It'll always be sentimental, not like a gut level. I see. On a good way, these guys are riding into the rescue just at the right time, I think.
Well, Larry, we are into what they call the fourth industrial revolution right now, so that could burst just in time for yet another spinoff series from this.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, so that's what Alex Kurtzman had to say. As I mentioned, Trek Movie did a transcript, so if you go over to their website, trekmovie.com, you can read all this mm-hmm. and watch the video. It's posted over there. Let's move on, Larry, to conventions. So one reason that we're doing this right now, it's been a couple of months since you and I sat down and talked about Discovery, but we're still several months away from the launch, or mm-hmm. a couple of months away from the launch.
Couple months, right.
One reason we're doing this right now is because you're about to set forth on the summer convention circuit. San nice. Diego Comic-Con, July 20th to 23rd. Star Trek Las Vegas, August 2nd to 6th. San Diego, there's going to be a big panel there with the cast and creatives. And there's another panel that's going to involve a little bit of Discovery on Friday at 8 p.m. in room 29AB. There's a panel called Star Trek TNG at 30 and Discovery at T-. And then on Saturday in ballroom 20, that's July 22nd at 2:30 p.m., of course, Pacific time, because that's where San Diego is located. The cast and creatives from Discovery are going to be there. And that's, I think, where we're going to learn a bunch of new stuff, Larry. What do you know anything about what's going to be happening at SDCC?
Well, real quickly, this is very exciting because aside from the year JJ announced, I mean, if I've said this before, you know, the big Comic-Con hoopla missed Star Trek's glory years, right? The next-gen guys never got to, the original series guys, the next-gen guys never had their Hall H moment. And Hall H is the huge, huge 6,000-person venue for the biggest events. And that's where JJ introduced Zach Quinto and brought out Leonard Nimoy and melted the house down in 2007, maybe, if not 2008. But that was like the only time there was a huge footprint until last year they did the 50th anniversary. And Brian, it was a panel of like Shatner and Jerry Ryan and Brent Spiner and some notables across the whole franchise history. And then Brian gave a lot of spoilers about Discovery, which melted the world in. And we got those very first early two trailers. And then last year was the 50th anniversary, and Spock was on the cover of the hand guide. And but that was the biggest footprint Star Trek had ever had, because it's been absent for the last 10, 12 years when this is all boom. Yeah. So seeing this second year in a row of major discovery, because all the big media things are there, and there's a lot of elbow jostling for position. What was disappointing was that the Discovery panel is not in the big Hall H. Ballroom 20 is kind of like the second biggest venue, and I think it only holds 1,500, 2,000 people. So, which is still a lot, but it's a come down. There will still be a ton of people pissed because they're not inside. That happens at Hall H. People camp out overnight to get into things all through the day. So that'll happen. What's interesting also is 2 hours later is the Orville's in the same place. But it's exciting to see this big Star Trek footprint. There's some other non-official CBS ones. That one you mentioned on Friday, some guy named Dr. Trek is going to be. That's his panel, I think.
I've heard that he's quite knowledgeable.
He's all bluster, no bull, but I'm going to go check him out anyway. So Friday night at 8 o'clock, and then he's actually, if there's anybody actually listening, seriously, guys, if there's anybody listening tonight or this week before Comic-Con on Friday night, during the week, if you catch me and sign up for my Portal 47, I'm going to have an after party at whatever bar we can get into there. And there's 47 hotels and all the gas lamp, if you know the layout there. It's like a state fair. It's like a week of Super Bowl prep in 4 days. But if you're one of the bonus things I'll do is we'll all go and it'll be a drink on me. So that'll be after that Friday night, so we can get up and enjoy all the hoo-ha and discovery. But I want to say, you didn't have on this list, Chris, Thursday, the first day of Comic-Con at 3 p.m, at the Central Library, which is another venue they've opened up for Comic-Con panels. At 3 o'clock on Thursday, it's an idea I pitched last year based on all these people, but they approved it this year. There's a panel called Trek Podcasts, the SoCal HQ or something. Anyway, it was meant to spotlight some of the major podcast people and podcast networks that have a fairly regional handle. So I'm going to moderate it and speak up. You know, for Portal 47, you know, it's not a true podcast. And I can mention Trekland Tuesdays Live, which I do now at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, and 9 p.m. UK time.
Are you going to do that by writing on a poster board and holding it up to the audience?
I think I will, yes.
Okay, just like on Facebook, right?
Yeah, my little title card will be on camera. That's how I was told to deal with Facebook Live for right now, and have it be cute. No, for 5-10 minutes, I do kind of like we talk about here, only I do it for the world at large that can get to me on Facebook and afterwards. So little shout out there, because I think it's the first time I've got to mention it here on Ready Room. But that's my claim to fame. But I'll be moderating, and Trek FM's own Aaron Harvey, we've already mentioned, with Saturday Morning Trek, will be there. And Dr. Kayla Iacovina from Trek Movie and their podcast called Shuttle Pod. And Lisa Gutzkow from Trek Radio. And John Champion from Roddenberry's Mission Log. So that's on the network too. So that'll be 4 panelists and myself. And we'll talk about especially the world of podcasting relating to Trek. And we live in an interesting time. And I don't know about you, but there are I've heard there are a lot of plans afoot for Discovery. Seems to be spiking a lot of interest in this new media landscape we're in. So who knows what
that's
may
what I've heard.
Who knows what may come out further about that. But anyway, so that's an hour, and then we're going to go. And then that night, I'm going to go try to see my old friend Dan Madsen at the Her Universe fashion show. And then,
oh, good.
Yeah. Is it 6? And then I'm going to leave that early and go up. And there's a great improv group that does genre improv in L.A., and I've blogged about this, and there's a group called the Improv Generation, and they have running characters on a ship, but they basically do Next Generation era improv. And they're doing a show at 8 o'clock. They have a Facebook page, the Improv Generation. You can check it out. At 8 o'clock up in Old Town San Diego that I'm going to go up to Thursday night. So that's my Thursday itinerary. Sunday, I'm just going to do like do like God meant and rest after all the hoopla of the week ahead. So that's kind of my and there's the Starship Smackdown closes everything on Sunday afternoon. And I say this, there's 180,000 people there. There's 47 billion panels and events going on in several, you know, in 2 or 3 or 4 dozen venues, the convention center and some of the surrounding hotels. I mentioned the library. you know, there's things all over the place, but their app is online if you really want to see. And of course, it's all genres, all everything. It's all, it's comics, it's sci-fi, it's media, gaming, you know, and the exhibit floor has tons of CBS will be around there. Our friends, you know, John Van Sitters and Bill and Marion and all of them, they will be out checking all their licensees, and all the CBS licensees will be there with Trek stuff too and exclusives and all that. But anyway, but that's my personal bit. So if anybody's there, and if somebody is there and heard this, I would like you to come up and say, hi, I heard you talking about this on Ready Room, and I would love to hear from you.
So that's San Diego Comic-Con. So that's good to know, filling in the blanks there, because there was not a lot of detail on their booklet at the moment. Now, Star Trek Las Vegas, after you do that, you're going to come back and rest a little bit. You can recover for just a few days. Then you have to go to Star Trek Las Vegas, which is August 2nd to 6th at the Rio. I'm hoping you can fill me in here, Larry, on what might be happening there, because if you go to Creation's website right now, they simply say the brand new Star Trek TV series is sure to be a centerpiece of action during the convention in 2017 in Las Vegas, with its scheduled premiere to occur sometime after the convention. So they've really stayed on top of updating their materials here, Larry. Created by past Creation Entertainment guest Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman, and with major input from other past guests, including superstar slash writer slash creator Nicholas Meyer, and Roddenberry.com's Eugene Roddenberry and Trevor Roth, our expectations at the time of this writing are running high. Star Trek is coming back on television where we believe it should always be. And of course, the J.J. Abrams films are continuing too. It's great to be a Star Trek fan nowadays, and the convention should be bursting with excitement as such. Of course, we will try our best to have guests from both the new series and JJ features at the Las Vegas convention. So, Larry, Creation seems very certain that they're going to try their best to possibly bring you some exciting moments as a Star Trek fan. I was just laughing because it seems like at this point, they obviously have more information. It would be nice if they would update it. So, what's going on at Star Trek Las Vegas this year?
In defense of Adam and Gary and everybody at Creation, this is probably the blurb that's been up since last fall or last winter.
No, I know, exactly. Yeah, that's my point. Yeah. This is the blurb that's been up since then, yes.
And that's the intention. And on one hand, and I say this every, the last two or three years, here's what the deal is. Since CBS is really has not just been a caretaker like the fallow years, but actually been actively, right? And Paramount also, but even more so CBS. Since they're in charge of the licensing and all for even the movies, CBS, and we're talking network CBS, even though it's all access, they promote, they're in the business of this, and they're no dummy. They know that the numbers are at Comic-Con. They not only are the numbers there, but that's where they get to stand up and represent among all the franchises. It's almost like all the siblings are there, or all the cousins are there. Yeah. And that's really the most numbers, the most bodies, the most eyeballs. That's where the media is covering events.
Yeah, media exposure.
Media exposure. And if when Marvel and DC and BBC with Doctor Who, and when everything is all lined up in a row, they've got to be there repping Star Trek at the big thing. That's where they'll get the biggest media splash. Now, Vegas, and that's where the most mundane people are going to – the fans, the armchair fans, everybody's going to hear about it. And local stations and small media are going to pick all that up. The ripple out of Vegas, that's the hardcore fans who are already sold. That's preaching to the choir. And, I mean, there's two ways to look at this. And as somebody who's been involved with licensed media, we would have the same thing. When I did have a communicator, especially like when Enterprise started, we would say, hey, we're paying for our license. What's the deal? But you've got the licensing arm and you've got the media relations arm. And media relations publicity is concerned about getting things to, you know, back in the day, TV Guide or Entertainment Weekly or any mainstream press, because we're just a few thousand. We're the hardcore and we're paying for it, but their charge is to get to the most bodies and the biggest bang for the buck. And that's what's still going on here. So poor Adam and Gary, on one hand, you look at it like, well, this is the hardcore and we're paying for this and this is the really hardcore fans, and that's all true. But their main focus is going to be Comic-Con. If there's something announced and debuted at Vegas, that would be cool. But I don't know. Also, they're shooting. So actors and cast and writers, right. Maybe something will happen at the last minute, but they're giving them a few days off to come, you know, especially the ones in Toronto, coming down to San Diego and back. That's taking at least two or three, between flying and getting acclimated and doing some more media there, that's at least two, three, maybe 4 days even, right, out of their schedule. So they're shooting their big wad for San Diego. And if there is something for Vegas, they'll do it. Crumbs. I don't say crumbs. But fans should not take it as a slight. Obviously, Adam Gary, the creation staff, everybody wants something big there. And a lot of people would think, well, logically, it should be. But that's just the way the landscape is. And
yeah.
And it was that way with the movies, with the JJ movies. The big number, the big events went to Comic-Con. And sometimes, after a while, the actors will break out on their own and go. But especially right now, also,
right.
CBS is writing very tight herd. They don't want any spoilers. They don't want any leaks. They want a nice, controlled re-entry burn landing for the show.
Right. Well, and in comparison to the JJ films, what you're describing in terms of television production makes a lot more sense logistically as to why the actors wouldn't be able to attend Star Trek Las Vegas. And at the moment, yeah, I don't see anyone on the schedule. But what is happening at Star Trek Las Vegas?
A lot of people are going to the Rio for 4 or 5 days to hang out at the Masquerade Bar and then take a break and go. No.
How do you feel the mood is after you talked earlier in the show about the hangover from the 50s?
Well, I was...
When I look at the itinerary, I mean, it's, you can tell, like, this is the year after.
Yeah, and I'm not knocking anything there. I think it was almost inevitable. I mean, we're just human beings. Mm-hmm. And I remembered thinking last year, not so much even about the schedule and the program that's on the paper, but just last year, I called it 5-0 fever, because everybody, not just Americans, but I hear, you know, Australians and Canadians and Brits and Germans and all the Europeans, and people were saying, oh, if I'm going to go anytime, I'm going to go for the 50th. And it was such a destination event. And people may have saved up for 2 or 3 years to go, who normally can't just go every year because it is expensive. Right. So all of that happened last year, and people mostly had an awesome time. And I was curious. Now, they did keep five. They expanded to 5 days last year. I was curious they would keep that and come back to four. They were still at five, although I think Wednesday, the new added day of Wednesday, didn't start until noonish. So maybe not quite as revved up a day.
It's for people to arrive on that day.
Right. Although, what I call concreep, it's different from what some people are calling concreep as like stalkers, some of the female fans. But to me, concreep is how there's been this official and unofficial expansion of the con. People come earlier and earlier and talk on Facebook and Twitter. Where are you guys?
You know, Larry, I hear that some people even do like long road trip tour things leading into the convention.
Yes, they do that. We did that last year. Part of the big 50th hoopla was the Geek Nation tours that Terrace and I do, and we did that last year. We had talked about doing a one day this year, and part of the hangover effect, we just didn't have a lot of interest coming up, so we decided to hold off and come back maybe next year. So we're deciding whether or not to do the next big tour. We've already decided that we're going to make it San Francisco centric. We added that last year, but we're going to stay in San Francisco completely. Maybe go over to Lone Pine for the mountain bit that we did the very first year. But we're mixing it up every year, and we don't know exactly, but that's just to make it fresh for new people, or maybe the people that had mostly LA centric things last year.
Yeah.
That's coming. So that's, and we're not doing the day before. So that's happening,
But you ultimately end up in Las Vegas, and so...
Oh, right. Yes.
What's going to happen? I mean, the one panel, there's no discovery thing. The panel that most interested me in terms of this Star Trek Las Vegas was that they're going to have people together talking about the What We Left Behind documentary.
Right.
That they're doing Sunday. For DS9. That, for me, I mean, Ira's going to be there running it, and... For me, that would be very fascinating. And they've done that in recent years in Star Trek Las Vegas, too. They've had really, really excellent coverage of Deep Space Nine after many years of not.
You seem to have an extra little special interest in DS9.
Well, I do host this other show here on the network.
Oh, that's
called
right.
The Orb. I think it's about Deep Space Nine. Yeah.
Here, I thought you were just talking about this trend that I see where DS9 is picking up fans by the boatloads. Or by, should I, maybe I should say by the runabout loads.
The runabout loads, yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Which is catchy, as the years go by. As well, right?
Yeah. But Vegas is a little bit looser. There's a lot of things that are the same. Now, the last couple of years, they've been bringing out more like, they didn't used to have any at all, but the last few years, there are photo op backdrops that are out for fans. I know they try to look for some spotlight event every year. Again, it's hard to top last year. So there are moments, but nothing just right off the top of my head that just jumps out, but it's there. Here's the thing. The schedule, they never put the schedule up in final in Toto until about a week ahead. Sometimes it's been like the Saturday or Sunday before the show opens on Wednesday, although people have some things selected. So I'm going to be there. So John Champion and I and some of our other friends, Terras and Kayla from Trek Movie, Trek Radio, we and Bye Bye Charity and Chris from Bye Bye Robot co-sponsor what we call the Landing Party, which is at the Masquerade Ball, which is the main hangout bar there on the main drag inside the Rio on Tuesday night. So I call it Con Eve. That will be happening again, probably about 9, where we have trivia and games and prizes and things. People are there already. We don't have to advertise it, but it's that. And then I'm going to do a Dr. Trek show, my crowdfunding party that I do for a couple hours, probably for the last time at Vegas, on Saturday night around 9. But this year, I'm keeping a lighter profile this year. I'm going to be a little more footloose, fancy-free. I may be tabling, may not be. But I'm going to get out and mix with people. I may do some more live, some like Facebook Live filming and that kind of thing. And I want to talk to some of the Trek folk I haven't got to really talk to in a long time while we're there. And yeah, looking forward to seeing. And they do have a lot more writers this year. Brandon and Ron Moore and Ira and Andre are all there. I think Narain too. Mike Westmore is going to be back doing another makeup demonstration. He's doing a Vulcan this year. So it'll be exciting and fun. My wife, who has been shying away from the big cons after we went together for years and years and years when she worked on Voyager, she's coming in because she's never seen the Brat Pack do their bit, and that's the closing act Sunday night.
Yeah, so, I would love to go to that.
Yeah. So, no, it's going to be a little bit different Vegas for me, and I think the mood, not just me, but I think the mood's a little bit different for a lot of people. And what's interesting is that there's nobody there from Discovery. People are excited about Discovery, but I don't think the hyperness of it has kicked in. So I think next year will take care of itself. So it'll be an interesting time at Vegas.
It'll be a hot topic of discussion amongst the attendees, no doubt.
Oh yeah,
as they consume their beverages.
And you know what? I say at the bar, there's all kind. There are the folks that don't drink and hang at the bars. There are the folks that do. It's interest just as much as there are people who have nothing to do with costumes. And there are people that, you know, the cosplay is ramped up big time. So there's all kinds of fans. I'm just looking forward to that mix of people and talking to people. What I was going to say was, from the barometer that I see online, and again, I always preach about how you can't tell all the fandom from what's online, Twitter and Facebook. But I see lots of people in the unofficial Star Trek Vegas Facebook page, the official creation Star Trek Vegas page. There's one called Star Trek After Dark, where my events and a lot of other ones that aren't creation official things are listed. I see a lot of people saying they're coming for the first time, and they're still looking for first-timers advice. So there's still going to be a lot of excitement of new people, and I love talking to new fans. So there'll still be a lot of them there, apparently. So we'll see.
Yeah. It sounds like it will be fun.
Yeah.
And once again, this year I will not be making it over, but maybe eventually I will.
If you didn't come last year, then just hold off on this year and we'll, yeah.
Well, I think this year I can't even fly because of the danger of pressure in my eye. So it's always something.
Something. But well, eventually. If nothing else, there's a silver lining here. It was a good year for you to not be able to fly. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that makes sense. Makes me feel so much better.
Have it this year, not maybe like next year or the year after.
All right. Well, okay. So that wraps up summer conventions. We have one last thing to talk about on the show today.
Gosh, Chris, that's exhausted all the topics I can potentially think of. Is there something else going on in Trekland?
It seems like there is. At least there's something else going on here on the network, Larry. We do have an announcement to make. And you mentioned earlier, Larry, something about this new media space, podcasting, and there's a lot of like Discovery discussion and stuff going on there. And, you know, the weird thing about Trek FM is that we've got 24 different podcasts and we don't have a Discovery podcast. And people ask me all the time, Is there going to be a Discovery podcast?
Yeah, you should do something about that, Chris.
Yeah, we've been thinking about it, but, you know, we weren't sure what to do. So we went out searching, and we ended up on the edge of Federation space. And while we were there, we came up with this idea for a show called The Edge. Ah. And that is Trekafilm's new dedicated Star Trek Discovery podcast. And you're not going to have to wait long to hear it, because this show launches this Wednesday, July 19th, with 3 episodes.
Whoa. Now, wait. The show doesn't air until September 24th.
That's right. So what are we going to talk about, Larry, during that time? Well, one thing we're really good at here at Trekafilm is talking about all the minutiae, all the behind-the-scenes stuff, creative concepts, and the creative people behind the shows that we love. And that's what we're going to be doing until the premiere of Discovery on September 24th. So, as I said, this Wednesday, July 19th, 3 episodes of The Edge will drop. You can get a good feel for the show. After that, new episodes will drop weekly on Fridays, and The Edge is going to have a similar format to The Ready Room. You'll hear lots of different voices. We've made this a show where we can bring in lots of different guests each week. So we're going to have this mix like we do in our episode discussions here on this show. And on Wednesday, here's what you can expect. The Edge Episode 1, you're going to get to meet the hosts. We have 4 main hosts for The Edge: Amy Nelson, Aaron Harvey, Mike Schindler, and Brandon Shea Mutala. They'll be discussing plans for the show, what you can expect, a little bit of a San Diego Comic-Con preview, and some other things. Now, Episode 2 of The Edge, Larry, I don't know if you've heard about this or not, but Mudd and Sarek, they're both going to be on Discovery. And as it turns out, I think you grabbed your microphone and you sat down with Aaron and Brandon Shea and talked about this on The Edge.
That wasn't a dream. Okay, I guess I really...
That really happened. That was not an alternate timeline.
That was not the prophet circling me back around to a non-linear existence. Okay.
That's right. So you'll be able to hear Larry on the second episode of The Edge.
See, my Kelvin friends were all arguing with me that was Kelvin Larry that had done that. But I was like, no, I think it was Prime Larry. And they just about had me... No, it was a great show. We had a good time.
Now, episode 3 is cast and crew. Aaron and Mike are joined by Brandi Jakula and Sarah Buck. So 2 guests on that episode to delve into the careers and work of the cast and crew of Discovery. And this includes the actors, actresses, creative technicians, directors, writers, artists, pretty much everyone involved in the show. And this kind of discussion, as you were asking, Larry, like, what are we going to talk about between now and September? Well, this highlights some of what you'll hear on The Edge between now and the launch of Discovery. You know, as we often do on our shows, and especially Mike does this on Stage 9 with John Mills, and Aaron does this on Saturday Morning Trek, we'll be exploring the creative and production minutiae of Star Trek and how it ties to the larger world of entertainment. So it'll definitely have that Trekafilm flavor. It's something that I think will be very interesting.
That's cool, Chris. We should do that more often when I'm on your show.
Of course, you do that here on The Ready Room as well. As a guest, Larry, as a guest. Yeah. But, you know, I don't want to plug my own show. You're listening to it right now. Let's talk about the other shows. So, yeah, that's what we do when you're here. And that's why you have your own feed on the network, Larry, behind the scenes with Larry Nemechek.
That's right. But that's it. No, right. I was being totally facetious earlier. But yeah, there's so much catching up we can do before the premiere and delving into. And I'm glad to see that the network has gotten so diverse. And Stage 9, beyond even the series by series shows, about getting into not just the actors, but the writers and the technicians and the creatives and the designers. Because these people, I remember thinking, when there was not a big house cleaning, but when they really tried to bring in the new blood on Enterprise, about how the cast is always this way, but a lot of other people had no idea that, oh, I'm the second assistant craftsperson's janitor, and suddenly, you know, 500,000 people are going to know who I am within 6 months and send me fan mail, you know? And it's just, there's more and more shows like that. Star Trek pioneered that, and now, you know, Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and all of them do that. But Star Trek pioneered it. But this group is all about to learn what it means to be any name in any position as a Star Trek crew and cast person. Because they're instantly going to be in the focus, and they're going to be asked about things, and they're going to be asked about things for the next 50 years. So they'd better get
exactly
right.
So
it ain't like so no exactly. other show.
So get your day one software on your computers, guys.
Yes.
And make sure you take really good notes every day of what you do as you're making Discovery. Because, yes, 50 years from now at Star Trek Las Vegas, they're going to be asking you questions.
Right, at the 100th anniversary show, they'll be...
And you need to remember what you had for lunch.
Yes.
On September 24th. All right, so that's our plan leading up to it.
Well, that's exciting.
Once Discovery launches, there will be a lot more activity on the Edge. We have some really exciting things in store for you. I'm not going to reveal what they are right now. I'm going to leave it to Amy, Aaron, Mike, and Bichet to fill you in on all those details on the actual show itself. But I will just say that this is going to be a bit of a different kind of podcast than anything that we've done before. Spock might say, Larry, it's like nothing we've seen before.
Readings are off the scale, Captain. We'll get a bigger scale.
But yeah, this is going to be a different kind of podcast, and I think everyone's going to really enjoy it. You won't have to wait an entire week for your next trip to the Edge after Discovery launches, so stay tuned for that. But this Wednesday, check it out. You'll find the Edge in the Trek FM Master feed, and of course, there will be a standalone feed this Wednesday, July 19th, we'll take you to the Edge. So those are our plans for Discovery.
Take it to the Edge. Well, you know, we talk about how the Discovery is the first show to launch in the social media era, but it's also the first one to launch in so much, I start to say citizen media, fan citizen media, you know, unofficial people with the technology to do this. To follow week to week, and it's exciting. Everything that's been done in the realm the last 10 years has been on the Dead shows, you know, analyzing and reanalyzing and reloving and reliving. Wow, that was catchy. But this is the first time, again, old fans, new fans, veterans, rookies, newbies, 80-year-olds, 8-year-olds, everybody is at square one with Discovery, with the show, with the Trek, and with the landscape that we've got to play in. And it's just, it is exciting. And I think that's going to start creeping up. I think it's starting to get out there, and people who are upset about the all access and or the canon issues and all that, and that's going to be out there. And we talk about how that's been there with every new Star Trek. But there's enough new going on with this show that's also going to weave into the fabric beyond just the show itself and the format. So it's infectious just to watch the tweets go by and the Instagram posts of the cast and the writers. So I would tell everybody, if you're out there, if you're not following, especially Ted Sullivan, Carter Hall, at Carter Hall, and some of his cohorts, there's something every day. And sometimes they're doing a private joke back and forth among themselves that they can't. They're talking about something they're working on, and you don't know what it is, but it's cute just to watch them argue without specifics, you know, at each other. And there's,
you try to read between the lines.
And there's the exploits of Jason Gorn, their writing room. And then Nick Meyer still has the Stella Star Trek dog Twitter handle. So anyway, it's fun. I'm just telling everybody. You get a good sense of you are there in the moment, even though you don't know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah.
It's fun to feel like you're connected in and in a way, again, that we've never been able to do before. So.
Exactly. All right. So those are our plans. And Larry, I know you'll be guesting from time to time on the Edge, so people will be able to hear your thoughts on Discovery there. And you know, once the Edge is launched, we will probably not be talking about Discovery as frequently on the Ready Room anymore, because we'll have a place to do it over there. So everyone, check it out. Well, Larry, it's been very good, and I would say, based on the outline we started with, surprisingly long discussion of Star Trek Discovery.
Sorry,
that
Chris.
We had today. But that's what you and I always do when we sit down at the mics. I hope everyone's enjoyed it, but Discovery isn't the only thing we've been talking about on the network this week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
It's kind of weird if you walk into Picard's ready room and, you know, a sad John Mayer song is playing.
Exactly. Or if he was listening to Jewel. You know, that would be really, really unexpected.
Oh, man, that's bringing it back right there. I can totally see him listening to the Pieces album.
To the journey!
But imagine how much his big black eyes would have popped if he was wearing the blue face paint.
That is true.
Like a bullion. I didn't realize the bullions were Scottish, but you know.
Bullions could be Scottish.
Meta Trex.
Trip is just absolutely fascinated with the pan-fried catfish that this replicator can make, and Archer doesn't want anything to do with it. He's pushing back against it. He doesn't trust.
What is it, like a Trojan catfish or something?
The Ready Room.
And then that makes you wonder, what does the Federation do when a member world shifts in that way and starts to take on characteristics that go against the foundation of the Federation Charter in the first place?
Yeah, is there some sort of process for like removing a world from the Federation? If they go too far from Federation norms and values and ideals?
I think so. I think they hold a Fexit vote. So they decide that they are going to leave the Federation.
Yeah.
This is Stratos, though. It might be a Strexit vote.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website or grab the RSS link. And of course, this show, The Ready Room, is also available on Spotify, if you want to catch me on there. Now, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion of Discovery. Do you agree with our takes? Do you disagree with our takes? There are many places for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place is probably on Facebook. You can join in the larger conversation on the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. And if you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room. That'll come right to me by email. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our username there is trekfm, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/trekfm. Larry, we talked about all the things you're doing at the conventions coming up during the show, but you always have a lot of other activities going on. Is there anything else that people should be on the lookout for?
Well, I mean, we talked about it already, Chris, but yes, the hub is always LarryNemechek.com. Portal47.net for my, you know, mini-con every month. No savvy fans gone before. But at Larry Nemechek on Twitter and YouTube, and at Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and on Instagram. And also, again, I invite everybody to stop in at 1 p.m. on Tuesdays Pacific and 4 p.m. Eastern and 9 p.m. UK for my little 5-10 minute commentary that I call Trekland Tuesdays Live on my Facebook page, on my Larry Nemechek Trekland page. Just 5-10 minutes talking like what we do here, maybe a little news, maybe a little some more dots that need connecting as this audience is used to. And if you don't get to bop by, share it with other fans, you know, it's out on Facebook Live, so it's really easy to get to. So, yeah. And you know what? I'll even say this. Again, if you're listening to this and you're at Comic-Con, especially here real quick, come up and say, hey, Larry, I heard you and Chris just this last week on Trek FM. We have our Thursday afternoon panel at 3 at the library, and my main panel is 8 o'clock on Friday night. And then I'm taking whoever signs up for Portal 47 over for a bonus drink on top of everything else at whatever hotel bar is nearby that we can get into. And I will say this, Chris, if anybody's listening tonight and they're not at Comic-Con, jump on the site between now and Friday, and I'll give you the Comic-Con bonus, which is your choice of a call sheet from the latter shows. And I'll get you a free drink the next time I see you at a con. Or send you one in the mail. Or whatever works out best.
And that site would be Portal 47.
Portal47.net. Yeah, there's an online button there you can use when you're not live with me at an event. But if you are live at one of the next two big conventions coming up, I hope you're there. And I've got some stuff coming on up in the fall, but I bet we'll talk before then. I'm going to be back in central Michigan around Detroit in the middle of August, also on the library tour again, too. So, but you can see all that online.
All right. Very good. Well, if you would like to find me, you can find me in social media. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook, pretty much everywhere in social media. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me hosting The Orb, as we mentioned during the show today, our Deep Space Nine show. And you can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. Otherwise, I don't have any exciting things going on like Larry does right now, but as several people have found out in recent months, if you happen to be coming through Tokyo, do let me know and we'll go out and have beers.
I hope to do that sometime soon.
Yes, you have to get over here sometime soon, Larry. I'd also like to thank my associate producers here on The Ready Room. It's thanks to these guys that I'm able to put this show together and get it out to you. Renee Roberts, who has been supporting the show since the very beginning. Thank you so much, Renee, for your support. Also, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you so much to all of you for your support. And, you know, our associate producers, they get more involved in the network over time. Zachary and Kay are co-hosts on To the Journey now, and others are being more involved in the network too. So thank you so much. If you're interested in being an associate producer or just supporting the network and helping all of our shows get out there to the listeners, you can support the network through Patreon. We are listener supported. It's the only way that we can keep things going. And it does take quite a lot of money to produce, host, and distribute all of our podcasts every month. If you'd like to help us out, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. And we also have our special website called Patron Zone, which you get access to at the $5 per month level and higher. Our Patreon manager is Brandon Shea Mutella, who is also a host on The Edge. If you choose to support us, you'll be hearing from Brandon, and he'll pull you into the Patrons Roundtable and all the other great things that we have going on. So we really appreciate your support, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and I really do appreciate you helping us keep this venture going.
Amen.
Well, Larry, I can't believe we talked about this many Discovery things today, but at least I got my fill. Now I can get through the summer. We can head into football season, then Discovery drops, and then we'll have more concrete things to talk about from the edge of Federation space.
Absolutely, absolutely. Can I, let me just say one real quick thing. I have a little bit of news myself to announce at that panel on Thursday, so again, it'll be news on Thursday. If you're online, you'll hear about it that day. A little small project I'm doing.
Well, Larry, that's very interesting. I'm curious now to find out what your announcement is going to be. So I'll have to be patient and wait until after the panel.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will, Chris. Because otherwise, you know what? It's time to stick an ancient Klingon painstick in it, because the Ready Room is done.